From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about fly fishing because it's summer, and for some, it's going to mean hours with a rod in hand. For those who do it, fishing with a fly is more of a challenge than fishing with bait or a lure. There's an art to it, and it can take a lifetime to get it, which is fine for most, as it's also an obsession. Two local writers have new books out, essays about their lives and fishing. We'll be right back.
With the KUER app, you'll never have to choose between Doug Fabrizio and a phone call from your spouse. Just hit the pause button and take the call. When you're ready, hit play and it's back to Radio West. The KUER app lets you pause whatever you're listening to, and you can get a constant feed of BBC News and classical music with our other streams, BBC on KUER and KUER Classical. It's even got an alarm clock, so you can wake up with Diane Mezzapinto's Moon Report and Morning Edition. Download the KUER app for iPhone and Android today. It'll help you be a better partner.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are two new books of essays recently out from Utah writers, Maximilian Werner and Jeff Metcalf. And they're both friends, good friends. In fact, they weave their relationship into some of their stories because they share a connection and an obsession with fly fishing. We made a film about Jeff Metcalf a few years ago. It featured one of the essays in his new collection. It was about how he used fishing as a way to heal himself as he struggled with cancer. In it, Metcalf talked about how the river speaks to him in a way that made him see parallels to his life. Last week, we invited Metcalf back, asked Maximilian Werner to also join us to talk about their books, but mostly about fishing. Jeff Metcalf is a professor in the English department at the University of Utah. His new book is Backcast, Fly Fishing and Other Such Matters. Werner is also at the U. He's a professor in the Writing and Rhetoric Studies department. His new book is The Bone Pile, Essays on Nature and Culture. We also asked Heidi Lewis to join us. Fly fishing is an obsession for her as well. She's the founder of the group Utah Women Fly Fishers. In one of his essays, Jeff Metcalf says that all fly fishermen come to the water first through a spinning rig and a worm. And that's where we started.
I think that I probably would never have picked up a fly rod. I did a lot of deep sea fishing when I lived in the Middle East and came to Utah, and people are talking about trout fishing and you could catch like a 2-pound trout. I'm thinking, you know, that would be bait. And I spear fished, you know, in the Persian Gulf. And then had it not been for a poker game in college, I would never have picked up a fly rod. It just seemed like a very silly thing to me.
Why? Because impractical. Like, I can catch more fish with something else.
You know, and I don't know if I would have been I wouldn't have done any spin fishing here. You know, when you fish the deeps of the Persian Gulf, it's pretty hard to imagine something really exciting here. And I was a person that needed to be enlightened myself. And so after, you know, winning this fly rod and 24 duck decoys and an over-under shotgun and a pair of red ball waders that belonged to like a 6'6" basketball player, I eventually went out. There was a great old fly shop, Doc Olson's, and went in and got flies and went up and decided I'd try it. And the waders had been folded up for probably 5 years. Put them on, stepped in the water, and they immediately filled up. I looked like, you know, the Michelin tire kid. And first cast caught me in the cheek, second one in the ear, and I thought, this is so stupid. But then the worst thing possible ever happened.
You caught a fish.
I caught a fish. Yeah. And it wasn't anything big, but there was something that set in motion a conversation I had with myself about, you know, this beautiful spot up here, and this requires some thinking and concentration. And that was my downfall, you know. I immediately became a fishing slut.
You know? wrote in that essay, I knew deep down that somehow the water would call me back.
It does, you know. And I mean, it's been, you know, I've mentioned this before, but I really think The Call of the Wild, you know, hey, that'd be a good book, wouldn't it? Call of the
That's
Wild.
A good title.
Yeah, I like that. But nature is deep balm for the soul. And particularly for me, it's water. It's always been water, and I'm drawn to it any place. I'll drive through a parking lot. If the sprinklers have been on, I'll get out and study that water. There might be a fish. That's the beautiful thing about fly fishing. You know, with every cast, there's possibility.
Yeah.
You know, you can do that. You can play golf and, you know, take 700 swings and hope you hit the ball. You know, people behind you would kill you. But, I mean, so we find it in our own way. And to answer your original question, at least from my experience, you know, I started my kids with spinning rods, and they're both great fly fishers. And my grandkids now are about ready to try a fly rod. So, you know, it's a wonderful gift to be able to give somebody.
Gift comes up. That's the word you use. Max, I want to hear you on this. Jeff writes about how it requires patience, fly fishing. And he says, and it requires the renunciation of that satisfying plunk of weighted tackle. Like, it's easier to do a, you know, just a spinning rod. Talk a little bit about that for you, like when you made the transition, if you did, and how you did that.
My experience was a little different than Jeff's in the sense that I, too, began with a spin rod, but I was actually using a fly. So it was sort of a hybridization of those two formats. And the rod itself was actually a gift that was given to me by a Mi'kmaq Indian neighbor of mine where I grew up in Caribou, Maine. And it was, you know, she gave it to me at a time when we were just about to move west here to Utah, and my mother had already gone, and my brother and father and I were left there to our own devices. And so I had a lot of time to go out and wander, and that's what I did with a purpose. And on that particular afternoon, I went a lot farther from home than I had normally gone and encountered this little offshoot of Caribou Stream and, you know, proceeded to catch my first trout. And not only did I catch it, but I gutted it somewhat failingly in a little cemetery that wasn't far from my home. And from that point on, actually, it was a little different in the sense that, you know, because of the sort of untutored experience that I had had and unguided experience, I guess you could say, after I moved to Utah, I mean, that was it. That was the end of it. And there was one other time when I fished with my grandfather on the snake, but that too was with the spin rod. And it wouldn't be until many years later in the early 90s when I would return from Arizona State University, you know, from graduate school in the summers. And one of my childhood friends took me out and then that was that. And then over the next 2 years, I kind of learned the basics of it and then moved back and was at 2005 and had kept in touch with Jeff throughout the years and went and found him. And that sort of was what took me to the next step in my education as a fly fisher.
How did you start? Did you start with the spinning rig? How did it work?
I started with a stick and a worm.
Right?
Yeah, when I was two.
Yeah.
So I grew up in southeast Wisconsin. And I have a picture of me cutting up worms as a two-year-old little girl on the end of a dock, catching bluegill and perch in northern Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And so mostly bait fishing and gear fishing.
Yep. What is the difference then, aside from the obvious mechanics between lure fishing and fly fishing? Like, how do you describe it, Heidi? What's the difference between that experience when you were catching bluegill and when you're casting a dry fly on a river in the West? Like, what's the central difference, if there is one, as you can describe it?
I mean, I think it's a night and day different experience. Most lure fishing that I've done has been in lakes and still water, and most fly fishing I do are in rivers. So that's a completely different experience, places you are. But you can fly fish pretty much anywhere. I guess you could lure fish anywhere as well. But, I mean, the casting's different. The mechanics are different. I don't know. Everything's different about it.
How do you describe it as being?
Oh, I'd see it. I understand what Heidi's saying here. But I think that you're more in tune to the surroundings when you're fly fishing because you're constantly moving. I mean, you can stand on the end of a dock and which I've done before, and have a great day of fishing. But, you know, once you step into that water, you're in the seam. And I don't mean that as a pun, but you are. And, you know, you might walk 10 miles in a day on a river, and you get all the wildlife around it, you know, looking for little boils or something like that. It's just different for me. And mm-hmm. you're fully engaged from the minute you see that river as you're pulling up to the minute you step in it.
It seems like that's the thing for you, Max, also, mm-hmm. that engagement, because this is something you write in your book and your essays, that the being part of that environment, being connected to it, that's a big part of it for you.
Yeah, absolutely. There? Well, you know, so based on my experience with spin fishing and my conversations and observations with spin fishers, I think for me what it comes down to is the purpose. And I think generally speaking, I'm sure there are some spin fishers, and I don't know if there are any bait fishers, but certainly there are some spin fishers who, you know, catch and release and, you know, make that their habit. But beyond that, I think, you know, generally when we bait fish, or certainly when we bait fish, and sometimes when we spin fish, the purpose is probably more to catch and to kill and to eat, hopefully, and avoid the oblivion of the freezer, right? But for me, the... you know, the difference lies in the fact that that's not my main priority as a fly fisher. My priority as a fly fisher is to reconnect and to ask questions and to observe and to not only better understand the environment in which I find myself, but then also to better understand myself, hopefully, through those reflections. And certainly the whole idea of reflection is a pretty prominent trope in all of fly fishing literature, at least the literature that I've encountered.
That's something you write a lot about, too, the idea of reflection and going through, Jeff, the still going through the experience of having cancer and confronting your own mortality. This is something that you've written about. In fact, we've talked to you about this before.
That's true.
A film about this, a short film, which I will direct people to on our website, about you. The way you think about mortality and death, frankly, and this experience you had on a stream with a particular fish that you had to watch die.
Right. Yeah.
Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was a very, very sort of dark moment in prognosis. And I went fishing because, you know, in probably 10 seconds on the water, I begin to forget what I'm dealing with, and I'd hit a beautiful trout that had wrapped itself around a rock, and I tried to take it off, shake it off, walk around, do everything. I couldn't go out to it because it was swift water, and I realized watching this trout that it would probably drown to death, and it you know, it broke my heart. I mean, I saw parallels to my own life, you know, that the unexpected happens. And, you know, it's the only time, I think, in a number of years there was such a, you know, felt like such a life and death struggle, mm-hmm. you know, and yet I couldn't help. I couldn't be part of that. There was nothing I could do to change it. You know, I was just thinking, I just got back from 3 days with a project called Real Recovery, where you take men that have cancer, various cancers, and you put them with guides, buddies, and you take them out fishing for 3 days, and they are, for the most part, broken and frightened when they get there. 90% of them have never fly fished before. And our job is to take them out into the wild, these beautiful ponds, and fish there, and not talk about what sort of cancer they have. If they want to talk, they'll talk, and put them on fish. And by midday of the first day, there's a little bit of conversation coming on. By that evening, when they've caught fish, they've got a suntan, and almost every one of them says, you know, has said that when I'm on that water, I never thought of cancer. And by the end of the third day, these guys are talking like experts. It's like, I hooked into a big pig, Metcalf couldn't net him fast enough. You know, it's just a beautiful thing. And one of the gentlemen I worked with was very, very sick. He'd have to sit down every 10 minutes on a chair that I carried along. By the end of the third day, he wouldn't sit in his chair, you know, sun tanned. And he said, I really felt like I was 30 years old. And that's probably does a better job of explaining it. Mm-hmm. And for me, having been in that company of men before on the other side as a participant, and now coming back every year as a volunteer, it's a reminder, you know, how fragile it all is and just how important the natural world is in our life.
Mm-hmm. Heidi, what about you? The the way you connect with the natural world when you fish. Do you think about it in those terms as well?
Absolutely. I mean, you have to be completely present, really observant in what's going on around you. You get your feet wet, you get in the river, and you can completely clock out and forget about everything else except what's right in front of you. If you're not aware of how the river looks, what the bugs are doing, what the birds are doing, you know, you have a much harder time catching fish.
Heidi Lewis is the founder of the group Utah Women Fly Fishers. Jeff Metcalf is a professor in the English department at the University of Utah. His new book is Backcast, Fly Fishing and Other Such Matters. And Maximilian Werner, also a professor at the University of Utah, his new book is The Bone Pile, Essays on Nature and Culture. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
KUER teams up with local and national businesses around the state to support the station and bring you Utah stories and national news from NPR. If you've got a business, like a restaurant or a car repair shop, or maybe you take wedding photos or offer legal services, whatever it is, when you join KUER as a business sponsor, you're helping people who care deeply about facts and storytelling stay connected to their community, all while building your company's brand. Learn more about becoming a sponsor at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about fly fishing because it's summer and it's also the obsession of two writers who have new books of essays out, Jeff Metcalf and Maximilian Werner. We also have in the conversation Heidi Lewis, founder of the group Utah Women Fly Fishers. I wanted to ask you about, Max, you say in your book, in one of your essays, that you can walk the shores of any water in the world and get a sense of about people's attitudes toward the environment. What do you mean?
Well, I think that particular or sentence comes from the essay I wrote called Lower Provo. And that essay is about a day that Jeff and I had on rare occasion, the two of us had gone down to Lower Provo to fish and had encountered a great many things, including a young man who, toward the end of that essay, do you remember that, Jeff?
Yeah,
when
I do.
He found this tractor tire that had, you know, come off the road and was laying in the grass. And I mean, it was a big tire, and he proceeded to lift it up and roll it into the river. And what troubled
you
me
were
about,
mystified.
Yeah, I was just totally, you know, I struggle with that memory now that you bring it up. But what troubled me about it was A, that he did it, and then B, that I just sort of stood by, you know, in complete bewilderment that he would take it upon himself to do this. And so I don't know if Jeff remembers, but you know, a couple minutes later, I had asked him if he saw what the kid did, and he said no. And then I told him, and
it was probably better.
But that, you know, that made it, you know, equally troubling because it meant that I alone was responsible on some level for, you know, in effect allowing this to happen. And so I guess the point I was trying to make with that particular sentence is that. You know, you can look at any natural environment, especially those heavy multi-use areas like the Lower Provo, and make some pretty accurate assumptions about how people are interacting with the natural world. And granted, of course, a lot of that garbage probably comes from the highway that runs parallel to the river. But certainly, it's never a good thing to see that sort of disregard, especially when it's just so easy to keep our trash to ourselves.
Yeah, it's a multi-use property. I mean, you'll be on that water sometimes. You'll see tubers, kayakers, you know.
I always see tubers when I'm on the lower.
I try to hook them. I don't have a big enough net. That's the problem.
We call that the rubber hatch.
The rubber hatch.
Is that right?
Yeah. That's the term.
I love it.
If it makes you feel any better, though, I have done some river cleanups with my children and kind
that's
of
important.
Mitigated that.
Absolutely, yeah. That's important.
But this actually gets to another question, and because I'm having a hard time imagining any of you actually on the lower Provo because it's so crowded. Talk a little bit about the solitary nature of this. I mean, a lot of people go to the lower, and they still do. It's great. It can be, mm-hmm. but it's also packed. And so the idea of trying to be, I don't know, is being alone important in terms of fishing for you, Heidi?
For me, it is. I need some quiet time in my life. I have two little girls, busy life. To turn my brain off is super important. So to get that solidarity, though, I often fish off season when there aren't a lot of people or on nasty weather days.
Really?
Absolutely. Or I, you know, try to plan ahead so I can have a full day so I can drive somewhere else. But our home waters, those close rivers, are still a sanctuary for me. You know, you can find your little nook, your little piece of water, even with a lot of people around. You know, you can make the best of it when you have to.
When did you start fly fishing here? How did you discover it? I'm not sure that's the right way to put it, but
sure. I started in 2012, so pretty recently.
Yeah.
My husband had been fly fishing. I would watch. I'd put on a worm. I'd catch a fish. He wouldn't. And then I started getting a little bored. I'm like, oh, I've always done this. Maybe I need something, you know, to the next level. I didn't want him to teach me. I didn't think that was really the best idea. So I ended up going to an F3T, a fly fishing film tour with him and some of his guy friends. And I saw those films and I was enlightened.
What do you mean?
They were just wonderful films. It looked really fun, the places they went. I can't even remember what films I saw necessarily, but it kind of lit a fire inside. And so I contacted the local fly shop, Western Rivers, where I saw people casting out front. And I'm like, maybe they have classes, you know? And then they had a women's class offered a couple months later, one seat left, signed up, and the rest is history.
When did what was the moment for you on the river when you went, like Metcalf writes about the time he snagged his cheek and he left the hook in his cheek and his earlobe in the essay. It just cut him off, figured he'd take care of it later, but then he catches a fish and it was kind of an epiphanal moment for him. There was something about it. When did you have that kind of experience, if you can mark one experience, or at least the time when you realized, I think I get this. I really like this. This is something I want to keep doing.
Well, the first class that I took, I caught two fish on the Middle Provo. Oh,
nice.
So that was pretty cool. And I was like, well, maybe I can do it. I got this. And so I would go out and fish again after that. And I'd go by myself. I'd take the dog, try to get out once a week to figure it out, and I kept getting skunked. And I'd go through the seasons and kept getting skunked. And it took about a year at least, you know, getting through every season, all the different hatches, to kind of figure it out a little bit. And so when I went back to, you know, the spring blue wing hatch the next year and caught the fish that I missed the year before,
right.
Now I'm like, I think I can figure this out. I think I got it now. But every day I'm humbled and I screw up and I fail and I win some days. And I still have all those feelings that come up. I know I don't have it all figured out. I think in fly fishing, if you think you have it all figured out, you're doing it wrong.
Is that true?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, fishing's always great. Catching is a different story, isn't it? You know, but I mean, it really is. I mean, I'm just fascinated. I need 100 more years to really understand it.
I wanted to ask you all about, there's something that Max writes in an essay. Max, you write about that it makes zero sense to use a fly that isn't represented in the trout's environment. And that trout have a different ways of seeing the world. And I want to get to that in a moment. But then you also have this experience where you are with Metcalf going after steelhead. And he rigs up this, this is how you describe it, this disco pink and orange and black stonefly. And you're like, wait, that doesn't seem like... that doesn't seem natural. Why? That doesn't make any sense to you. And then he told you, usually it's not about eating. It's about defending. Would you just talk a little bit about this, the idea of what it is you're presenting in front of a fish? And how you're trying to imagine the way the fish is behaving. And I want to hear you all on this point.
Well,
you
so start. At the time of that trip, I had never been steelhead fishing. And in fact, Metcalf had approached me with the idea for, I think, 3 or 4 years in a row, and I could never get it together to join him. And I finally did it and was really unprepared for the magnitude of that experience, both because of the place where we went, but then also because of the size of the water, you know, the river, the Stanley is much larger than any river that I had ever fished.
And it's crazy during steelhead season because it can be very dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot to be mindful of. And if you went down out in that water, I mean, there was nothing that these guys were going to do. I mean, they might be able to pull me out a couple miles down the river.
Well, unless
you had
a fish. Yeah. And then we'd get the fish.
Then you'd come and get the fish. Yeah,
and your rod.
But up to that point, you know, because I had only fished or primarily fished the rivers here in Utah, I was used to a very a particular way of a presentation and thinking about the, you know, relationship between the trout and its different prey species. And so, you know, when Metcalf tied on that disco bug, it just, you know, completely floored me, and I just couldn't understand why. But then, you know, later I realized that what was happening in that particular case is that you're counting on the ire of that steelhead, and perhaps the best way to provoke that is by, you know, running by it this large sort of, not necessarily threatening, but certainly agitating looking insect, and that's what I did. And then the other part of it that I enjoyed is how it demonstrated and how fly fishing continues to demonstrate for me the power of the imagination. And this was a realization that I stumbled on pretty late. You know, I'm a pretty, you know, analytic guy, but, you know, I miss a lot, you know, when I'm out there. And I think that has a lot to do with a lot of things, including, you know, where I'm at in my mind. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the things I've learned recently is that you can get pretty entrenched in, you know, your ways of doing things on the river, and which is odd because the river is always changing. You know, the place where I was telling Heidi before the show that there's this little spot up near Midway where I fish, and I've been fishing there now for, it's like called Creek, and I've been fishing there now for about 7 years, and it holds some of the largest. Metcalf can attest to this.
Yeah,
it holds some of the largest
trout
I've ever caught. Yeah. And in Utah, and you know, and one of the interesting things about it is that the water level often fluctuates, and every time it would fluctuate, I'd look at it, and if it'd been too low, I would think, you know, this isn't going to fish. You know, the fish just aren't where they normally are. But what that meant is that they were in other places,
yeah, exactly.
Right? And it just took me a while to kind of figure that out, and I would say that it was largely a result of my willingness to, you know, to ignore that voice in my head that said, oh, you know, there's not going to be anything there, and then actually trying and then, you know, having it yield results. So it's been a very interesting process, my education.
Is that how it works for you as well? I mean,
I think for all of us.
Yeah.
You know, that's the excitement, the unexpected surprise of landscape and water. Mm-hmm. You know, the place that Max took me into, and that was an appropriate name for it. It'll be bleeped, but I'd been there years ago, and it's very hard to get into, and I have a propensity for getting stuck in bushes and falling through holes. And when you're talking about, you know, a misstep, I do a lot of swimming when I fish because I'm not paying attention to where I'm standing. But these trout were frightening. They were so big. And Max said, I think you'll like this. I really disregarded that body of water, but I know Max well enough to know that there would be something there. And it was probably the largest trout I've ever caught on the Provo River. But I remember you saying, I think that's a log you're casting.
Yeah.
And I went, I don't think so, because it just moved. So that's a surprise.
Yeah. One of the things that Max, you write about is you mentioned that fishing, you say this, fishing like golf and skiing is said to be an emblem of economic status. You also write that you say, anymore I find it hard to justify the expense. And there's this rumination in this essay that you write about consumption and those kinds of things. And I kind of thought this would be a good opportunity to talk about the kind of perceived elitism that is sometimes connected with fly fishing. Max, you start.
Okay.
What were you getting at with that essay when you talked about justifying the expense and the kind of the consumption that you see on one hand, and how you all think about the cultural fly fishing and maybe the caricature or the stereotype that comes with it, that you're all packed, you know, in Patagonia gear and really expensive rods and all of that.
Yeah. Well, I think it goes back to something Heike had said earlier about being involved and trying to make, you know, meaningful change. And one of the perhaps many ways she does that is through her activism and, you know, and this river cleanup that you had talked about and so on. And so, you know, I often find myself asking, you know, what is my own way of doing that? I mean, because I've done river cleanups like that in the past, certainly not lately. And the only answer that I can really come up with with any sort of certainty is that I write about the experience. And, you know, one of the things that I don't think we can avoid is the fact that when we go to these places, however near or far, that, you know, we are impinging. You know, anytime we step into that, onto that river, we're impinging on it on some level. And, I mean, granted, of course, we want to do that to, you know, the minimal extent possible, but it's still happening. And I don't think anybody escapes that. I don't think anybody escapes the fact that, you know, their presence there is, you know, to be considered. And so it's a trade-off, you know, it's a balance. It's a, you know, it's trying to figure out a way to both enjoy the resource, if you want to put it in those terms, but then also enjoy it in a way that doesn't require or doesn't involve taking more than your share. Hmm. And, you know, so for me, that's meant different things over the years. And, you know, I've never, as I indicate in that essay, I've never been one of economic means. And in fact, the reel that I use presently, it's an old Ross reel. And my friend Tay No gave that to me in 91. And I still have that same – I've still used that same reel. Wow. And then I also use a snow rod that Anglers Inn used to make. Remember? It was their signature rod. So that rod is also – when was that? When were they around? It was, you know, 20 years ago. Yeah, it's been a long time. And for many, many years, I'd used – Metcalf can give his own experience about this, but, you know, I'd use the same pair of waders. And so I don't know that I've ever really been illustrative of that elitism that we so often associate with fly fishing. But, you know, certainly there's a segment of that demographic that's you know, for whom it's important to look great on the river, and I get that, but that's just not me, you know. And I laugh because I remember Metcalf sort of slogging around in these waders that are half dragging off his ass, and they've got all these patches and stuff on them. And I mean, I know you re-upped and got some new waders, but you wore those waders for a long time, and I think that's partly illustrative of our shared interest in guarding the resource.
What about you? How do you respond to that question, that when people are like, oh, you're a fly fisherman?
Yeah. So when I had this bright idea to start fly fishing, I'm like, I need to get out of the house, do something that's inexpensive. You know, I can do it by myself. I don't need a partner. Little did I know I would have a pretty hefty tab at the end of it. But getting into the sport, I didn't. I mean, I bought an inexpensive rod for $60, discounted, you know, got the gear I needed just to get out there. So it doesn't have to be an expensive sport, but I think with any sport, you do get what you pay for a lot of times.
And you do get obsessed.
And you get obsessed and you want bigger and better sometimes.
Yeah.
So you can keep it inexpensive and really simple, but I think the more you get into the sport, that it changes. You know, if you buy a $600 snowboard, it's probably going to feel better than a $250 snowboard, but you can still get out and snowboard with the lesser of the two.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same with fly fishing. So it can go either way.
How do you think about it, Micah?
Yeah, I'm not sure that's the right question, the expense of it, because, you know, I had a conversation with a guy in Montana that was a big hunter and had stopped by to look at this and was saying, aren't those rods kind of expensive? Well, I've been fishing with the same fly rods for I don't know how many years, and I did, you know, buy an expensive fly rod, and it makes a difference.
I mean,
but it's very old, you know, when I see people that fly rods mean a lot and probably have 1,000 of them, you know, they go, isn't that a so-and-so from 1492? Yeah, Columbus used it. But, you know, he was saying, well, that seems like an expensive sport. And this guy, you know, has probably, he told me he had like 3 great hunting rifles and they always go on this trip to hunt the meat and stuff. And you kind of pencil it out and it's like 10 times more expensive. The elitism is a different question. That might be
right.
The question, you know. I don't know how you answer that. You know, I really don't. And I'm you know, I think you do your best to show by example. You know, I've been up on the Provo, the lower Provo, actually, where a guy threw a worm thing, which you shouldn't be using anyway, on the ground, and I just went over and picked it up and put it in my vest. And it's like, oh, I was going to get that on the way out, you know. And there was no conversation beyond that, you know. It's a bad rap. You liberals and your fly fishing. I think we're conservatives and we fly fish. We're guardians of the water. You know, we're all involved in projects and we try to give back in that way. And we teach kids, you know. I mean, you know, I think of all the kids that I taught fly fishing in Valley High School. You know, these girls would be out there in their high heels, you know, in leather jackets, casting. And then we all went fishing. Some of them are guides now. It's a beautiful thing. It can be a fair exchange.
I think we might be preaching to the choir a little bit, because if you're not in the sport, you may not understand that. You know, years past, especially as a female angler, you have an image of fly fishing as a middle-aged white guy sport, and that's changing. And women have always been involved, but, you know, with social media, you see kind of a different light of things. So the elitism, I think, is there, but I think that
it's
image
diminishing.
Is changing.
As it should.
Right.
You know, I had a chance to interview Joan Wolf.
Oh, did you?
And we talked about that. Wow. And she was one of them, and still is, one of the most brilliant casters.
Absolutely.
And lived in the man's world. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of what we focused on in the conversation. Mm-hmm. And I can't even imagine what it was like in the 40s and 50s to be, you know, in that world as a very competent and better than most of the men she fished with. Mm-hmm. And I like to see that change. And it's wonderful to be on the water now and see a lot of women on the water.
I'd rather see women than men.
Oh, absolutely.
No.
I know what you're saying. That's almost funny, but you know, I know what you're saying. You know, I'd rather teach a woman how to cast a fly rod than a man.
Boy, you know, patience
well,
or
there women we go. Pay attention. Right?
Here we go.
Well, I don't. I really do. If you say try to load the front and the back of the rod at the same time, you know, men will always try to throw it on the front end. You know, it's easier.
We have less
it's just
ego.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, I absolutely agree with it. And when you said that you didn't want your husband to teach you, that's probably the smartest move you ever made. You know,
we've really been together for a long time. I knew how that was going
to
go.
Know that, you know.
I love him, but
when you go, one of the things Max writes in an essay talks about when you sometimes you'll have a when you go with each other, you Jeff, you and Max, you have a destination in mind. But sometimes you just go wherever the road will lead you. Talk a little bit about that when you venture out. How much of do you plan? How much is it? And all of you, Heidi, you too. Like, do you just like, let me just go somewhere and figure this out? How does it work?
Well, I mean, it depends on a lot of different things. Yeah. And mostly what it depends on is why we're going in the first place. And, I mean, clearly the initial reason is to fly fish, but you know sometimes what's more important is not so much that you fish, but that you go and you get out and you reconnect and one of the things I've enjoyed knowing Jeff for all the years that I've known him and really miss about fishing with him. We haven't fished together for a while now. It's been a while, but is the pre-fishing ritual. And so whether we have a destination in mind or not, we spend, you know, that drive time, you know, catching up and talking about things.
Yeah.
And those memories are some of the most treasured in my life. And I mean, and that's one of the things I love about writing about fly fishing. You know, there's the activity of it, but then the writing about it, you memorialize, you know, those experiences. And what a treat it is for me to go back and to, you know, read my earliest book and my first book and then to read these essays and to remember those times with Jeff. Mm-hmm. And they're just, you know, just crazy, beautiful memories of him that I have and you know, some of the most substantial interactions with other human beings that I've ever had. So, you know, we get there at some point and we see what we see and find what we find. And if that means traveling three different rivers in a single day, as we did in the essay triptych, then so be it. Or if it means going to one place and staying there, that's what we do.
And we've ended up fishing in the strangest places. We fished in a guy's pond in his house one time.
Oh, you know? Right.
And another time we fished right behind Morgan High School.
Right, yeah.
You know, and
that was crazy.
We ended up there, and it was a horribly cold day, and we walked the banks we crawled through brush, and we both caught one fish, and it might be one of my most delightful memories of that. And It's just all, regardless of who you're with, the conversation's always important, you know, and significant. We talk about being in our lives and teaching and school and problems and fish. Did I mention fish? I didn't. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that might be the last thing we talk about while we're driving along.
For you, Heidi, do you make a plan? Or you try to make it as spontaneous an experience in some ways?
A little bit of both. Yeah. I have trips planned years in advance sometimes.
Yeah.
I do. As a busy
wow.
mom and,
that's cool.
and business owner, I have to do that. Most important is just getting out there.
Yep.
So my time is limited. So I have a more tactical approach. I check flows. You know, I think about options, what's around, if this one isn't working, or you know, if this water isn't producing, or if it just there's too many people. So I have a little more tactical approach, but I love going to rivers with people, and then once we get there I usually kind of break up and do my own thing. But I like the travel, like you guys talked about, mm-hmm. with someone else, share stories at the end of the day if you don't always fish next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all that's just part of the experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to ask about this is something, Max, you write about Norman MacLean and A River Runs Through It, which is this iconic novella, story. And I wanted to maybe have you talk a little bit about it, because you write about it being one long and beautiful meditation on love and loss. And what I like about the essay where you write about this is kind of what we've been talking about, that it's not just about the catching of the fish. It's about these bigger things that are happening while you are fishing. Talk a little bit about that that story and MacLean's insight into love and loss and family and fishing.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the first thing I would point out, again, making the distinction between the activity and then writing about it, is that a lot of these insights and observations and awarenesses that I have aren't necessarily coming to me when I'm fishing. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there'll be things that Jeff will say or that someone will say or that'll happen that will stick with me that I'll, you know, later puzzle over and try to figure out in the context of the essay. And that's, I think, really what I love about the genre, is that it's so nimble and flexible. And even though it's exploratory, as long as you're making that exploration interesting, it's okay if you don't have all the answers, which, you know, I seldom do. But in that particular essay, I was describing that scene. In, of course, we all know the story, or many of us know the story of Norman MacLean and his brother Paul, who was murdered, and the time that they had spent on the river and what that had meant for them as a family, not just with his brother, but also his father as well. And you know, that story always stuck with me, and there was that – I'm not going to quote it here verbatim, because I don't remember it that well, but something to the effect that all the people that he had loved, Norman MacLean had loved, were gone, and that sometimes he still reaches out to them. And,
yeah.
And I just always – you know, I just thought that was such a beautiful way of thinking about it, and I think it's also germane to the genre as a whole, you know, that the literary nature of fly fishing writing has always been something that's been very attractive to me. And then, you know, as I've gotten on, I'm still into the aesthetic end of things when it comes to fly fishing. I don't see how you cannot be, just because of where we are when we fish. But then, you know, I'm also interested in trying to, you know, to get a handle on what's going on besides what's going on
yeah.
with me. And
there's this part in the mm-hmm. in that essay where you're writing about how Norman MacLean is trying to understand and his father. He's a minister, and they're trying to understand the murder of their son and brother. And Max, you point out that the Reverend tells his son Norman to make up a story and the people to go with it, and only then will you understand what happened and why.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like here's where you're making that connection between writing and understanding
yeah.
a story.
Yeah, I mean, it's a crucial part of processing, and it makes me wonder what people who don't write do. You know, I mean, how do they come to understand and process their experience when we don't write about it? And I'm sure there are perfectly good answers to that question, and certainly I could have answered that question at one point myself before I was really a serious writer. But it's such an integral part of understanding myself and what's going on that I don't understand. I can't see how I could live really without it. What about you guys? You're the one to answer that question. I mean, assuming you don't write, or do you write?
I don't write.
Okay.
I take a lot of photos. Mm-hmm. You know, I go back and look at those memories. There's a lot of things that you talked about, like the meditative part. You know, it's completely, as soon as my feet hit the water, I am in like this meditative state. It's really unique. And it does, after you get off the water, it takes some time to kind of process everything that happened and think about what went right, what went wrong, what did you see, all the emotions kind of flooding back and thinking about that. I don't get to write them down, but I feel like I should now after hearing from you guys.
You should write a journal.
I should write a journal. I have all those same feelings. I just don't write them down, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing that occurs to me is, you know, when Norman makes that point, he is in effect talking about, you know, the lives of the dead.
Yep.
And one could ask the question, what value is there in that? And I know there are all sorts of answers to that question, but I was working just with that problem this morning. I'm working on a new book about my research up in Montana, and I started thinking about Samuel Ives. And you guys may recall Sam Ives and how in 2007 he was dragged out of his tent in a campground in American Fork and killed. And then I started sort of ruminating on that whole thing. And I'm like, well, here's Sam. He's here in my life now. And what do I do with him? And then there was a point in that paragraph where I said that you know, that it was unwise for me not to abide by the teachings of the dead. And the idea is that by memorializing the dead, or by allowing Sam to speak in that moment of the essay, or other people in my essays to speak, I was being instructed by that. And perhaps I might, you know, avoid that situation myself some down the road, you know, and, you know, by taking preventative or cautions or measures in order to protect my own kids or myself. So, I mean, I think there's just a lot going on anytime we go out fly fishing and we start writing about it. And it's neat to be able to access some of those things and to wonder and to speculate, even in the absence of certainty. I mean, certainly there are a lot of things where that you can come to some certainty about what's going on. But just as often, there's a lot of doubt. And I think that's also generative.
You know, I was thinking about Norman Maclean and the idea, I think one of the lines following what you were talking about is how, you know, why is it we can't help the people that we love? Mm-hmm. And so part of it, you can never find an answer for that. You know, look at these shootings of late and you look for an answer. You can't. You have to look for a place. And my brother died mysteriously in Nicaragua. He had gone off to war and then never quite really came back and lived all over the place. And I wondered, you know, could we have done anything else? And it was not possible. You know, he wouldn't let us in. But on the river, which is something I do with people that are not here, if I catch a fish, I name the fish after that person and turn him loose. And there's great comfort in that. You know, I was thinking, I think it started with a professor I had, Phil Sullivan. And then, unfortunately, I've been naming a lot of fish lately, you know. But it puts my brother into the river. And it gives me great solace. You know, when I go there, and I think of my brother, and I think of the people that I fish with, had the pleasure, you know, and permission to fish with in my life. And we're all struggling to figure those things out.
Yeah.
I think you've said it eloquently, Max.
Thank you.
People who say, how do I do this and why should I do this? I think you've talked a little bit about this. The idea is just to get out there, I suppose. But what kind of guidance do you give for people who are looking for the experience of going fishing, when they talk to you about fishing?
Fly fishing.
Yeah. I mean, what do you say to them if you do? Maybe you don't want them out there because you don't want the
There's already enough
more
people,
crowded.
Right?
Yeah. I've gotten really selfish about that.
Yeah. Have you?
Yeah. You shouldn't go. You know, I mean, you just shouldn't go.
It's not that great.
Until we get better stream access.
Yeah.
Just wait. I it requires so much patience. I think you should try it. If it's not for you, that's okay. Try something else. I think there's a lot of people that want to just go out there and catch fish. And it's not that easy. And you kind of have to pay your dues a bit. You have to earn it. You have to learn it. You have to spend time. So try it out and see what it's like. But, you know, I would say stay patient. Work it out. Work out the kinks. Take some classes, possibly. The best teacher is spending time on the water, 100%. that's what you need to do to learn it.
You know, I'm sure we've all fished with people, and this is the dead giveaway. You know, you go out, and it's like, how long do you think we'll be here? You know, that's pretty much
I've done a good sign.
Calling Uber. But the answer is the entire time. You know, take me fly fishing and teach me what you know. I'm happy to take people that I think are really serious about it, but that's the answer. If you know, if we get there, and it's like, do you think we'll be out of here by 3? We might not even start till 3. Mm-hmm. We'll walk the water and study fish. Mm-hmm. So I have no patience. I hate to admit this, but I really have no patience for that kind of a conversation.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that having a guide is invaluable.
Absolutely.
Not necessarily a formal guide, although certainly that is very helpful. I found that, you know, going back to my childhood friend Noel, you know, he was gracious enough to take me out and to share that with me, and patient enough to let me fail at it, you know, without, you know, always trying to needle me or, you know, do this or do that. I mean, he gave me a very basic skill or knowledge set, and from there on, you know, I just sort of picked it up along the way. And now, today, when I go with people who may not have a lot of experience with it, I find myself having to, you know, to kind of hold back a little bit. And because part of the pleasure is, you know, letting them figure it out, you know, and letting them learn how to read water and to think, you know, more actively about the trout's relationship with the environment or how their own proximity to the trout or to the water might have some effect on that or the quality of the light or, you know, all these different things that I think would be a shame to give that person. You know, because that was what I valued about it, was just sort of learning that myself. And you have all these realizations, and then through those realizations, your connection is deepened. It's heightened. The experience is heightened. Whereas if I just tell you to do this, you know, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, working out the kinks on your own is mm-hmm. how you learn the sport. Yeah. And it's the biggest difference between fly fishing and spin fishing or gear fishing is you can just put on a lure and go out there and do it. And with fly fishing, there's so many more elements that need to be in place and discovered and learned.
Heidi Lewis is the founder of the group Utah Women Fly Fishers. Jeff Metcalf is a professor in the English department at the University of Utah. His new book is Backcast, Fly Fishing and Other Such Matters. And Maximilian Werner, also a professor at the University of Utah, his new book is The Bone Pile, Essays on Nature and Culture. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.